This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, Shoring Up Ukraine and Countering Russia. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. In April, senior U.S. and European officials said roughly 150,000 Russian troops had massed along the border of Ukraine and in Crimea, more than any time since Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea in 2014. Despite having pulled back some of the tens of thousands of troops, many remain. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky told U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who visited the beleaguered former Soviet state last week after G7 meetings, that, quote, Russia still has the capacity on fairly short notice to take aggressive action if it so chooses, unquote. Secretary Blinken affirmed unwavering U.S. support for Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity in the face of Russia's ongoing reckless behavior toward Ukraine, which still aspires to become a member of the European Union and possibly NATO. Kyiv's yearning to be associated with the West infuriates the Kremlin, which perceives Ukraine as part of its sphere of influence. The VOA News Center reports that Blinken said the United States is looking at further security assistance to Ukraine and that Russia's actions were the topic of extensive discussions at recent NATO and G7 meetings. Thursday's talks between Washington and Kyiv included the Minsk agreements to end the conflict in eastern Ukraine, where Moscow has been supporting pro-Russian separatists in the Donbas region. President Zelensky and Secretary Blinken also discussed efforts to help tackle corruption, which is plaguing Ukraine. The State Department says Secretary Blinken encouraged institutional reforms, which are considered, quote, key to securing Ukraine's democratic institutions, economic prosperity, and Euro-Atlantic future, unquote. In April, Washington imposed a wide-ranging sanctions package against Moscow in response to malign Russian behavior, including cyber attacks, election interference, and military actions aimed at Ukraine. Russia responded by expelling 10 U.S. diplomats from Moscow and additional measures barring 8 high-ranking U.S. officials from travel to Russia. Nonetheless, U.S. President Joe Biden suggested during a phone call with President Putin that the two sides seek to de-escalate tensions by meeting in a neutral third country. Well, joining us to discuss the implications of Russia's aggressive actions against Ukraine and the United States, we turn to two distinguished Russia and transatlantic experts who join me via Microsoft Teams. Will Pomerantz is Deputy Director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, and that's a think tank here in Washington. Will, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here.
And Andrea Kendall-Taylor. She's Senior Fellow and Director of the Transatlantic Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. That's a public policy group also based in Washington. Andrea, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
First to Will Pomerantz. Will, you know, given the large troop buildup by Russian forces on the border with Ukraine and, of course, in occupied Crimea, and its menacing activities in nearby waters, the Black Sea, what's your latest assessment of Russia's intentions vis-a-vis Ukraine?
Well, in terms of Russia's intentions in Ukraine, I think the primary reason why Putin moved all these troops and threatened Ukraine is because he doesn't want to lose Ukraine to the Western sphere of influence. Particularly, he doesn't want to allow Ukraine to join NATO. And I think that he showed his muscle. He showed that he can threaten Ukraine. And as a result, NATO will be much more reluctant to have Ukraine as a member because they don't want to immediately be engaged with the conflict with Russia. So I think it was just to show Ukraine what can be done and to deter the West and NATO from having Ukraine join NATO.
Andrea Kendall-Taylor, what's your take of Russia's intentions vis-a-vis Ukraine? What do their actions tell you?
In this case, I think there may be three different types of factors at play. So for me, the first factor is very much about Russia-Ukraine relations. And this is in many ways Moscow's response to what it saw as growing anti-Russian sentiment in Kyiv. And so we had seen in advance of the military buildup on the border, some anti-Russian moves going after Russian-linked oligarchs like Medvedchuk and some Russian media outlets. And so I think this was very much about Russia wanting to signal, first, that it won't tolerate any anti-Russian moves, and also a lot of frustration in Moscow about the lack of progress over Minsk. Zelensky had said that he wasn't willing to meet in Minsk, given Lukashenko's crackdown on protesters there. And so this was a way to demonstrate force, to put pressure on Ukraine to get back into the Minsk process and accept Russia's version of Minsk. But I also think it has something to do with the timing of the Biden administration. I think there's some concern coming from Moscow that Biden is very focused on China. And this is a way of Putin to be able to say that he too has a say where Russia will be on the U.S. foreign policy priorities. And so this is his signaling that the Biden administration has to take Russia seriously to compel Washington to deal with Moscow. And then finally, I do think that there is, although this is kind of a distant third, a domestic component for Putin. They have elections coming up in the fall, and we've seen from Putin this kind of besieged Russia mentality. And he has tried very hard to frame his military buildup as being in response to what he has said is unacceptable Ukrainian moves. So it's a way for him to kind of continue the drumbeat about external enemies and show that he is a strong leader. So it's a confluence of those three different types of considerations.
So turning back to you, Will Pomerantz, what about the Biden administration's approach? What's different now from the Trump administration, other than the obvious that former President Trump seemed to have some sort of a relationship with Vladimir Putin, that he could never criticize him? And of course, we have a very different approach from President Biden. But how significant is the visit by Secretary Blinken? And where does this fall in terms of U.S. priorities? Why is Ukraine so important?
Secretary of State Blinken's visit was very important just to show that the United States remains committed to the territorial integrity of Ukraine and the defense of Ukraine. And so I think that was really the main goal, especially in light of all the controversies that Ukraine has become entangled in over the last few years. I think that it was to show solidarity, especially in light of the military buildup that Andrea just talked about. But I also think that there's some issues that Blinken raised as comfortable with Zelensky and with Ukraine as before. And that's specifically in the area of corruption. There's just been a very controversial firing of the head of Naftogaz in Ukraine. Again, not only was it essentially illegal, but it was also not transparent. And it has sparked a great reaction amongst various investors with Ukraine, including the IMF and so forth, that Ukraine is not dealing with the endemic corruption that has plagued it since its foundation and its independence. So I think that Blinken was giving some reassurance last week, but also some tough love that Ukraine has to continue on the path of reform if it's going to continue to get the significant amount of aid from the West.
So, Andrea Kendall Taylor, do you think that Secretary of State Antony Blinken's presence there is a demonstration to Vladimir Putin that, yes, Ukraine is very important to us and that you are not going to in any way try to deter us and that we can walk and chew gum at the same time, deal with the threat that you are posing as well as from China? And how serious is Ukraine's internal corruption problem? How much of an impediment is that?
Yeah, I think absolutely that this was a really important signal of U.S. support for Ukraine's ability to stand up to Putin. You know, the United States has made clear in its strategy to Russia that it will confront Russia where we need to and it will engage where we can. And an important pillar of that confrontation is really standing up to the ongoing Russian aggression towards Ukraine. And so showing up in Kyiv this early in the administration was a really, I think, a very important signal of that support. And for the United States, having a successful Ukraine is really important for our broader goals in the region. I mean, we know from Putin's perspective that having a successful Ukraine on his border is a threat because it shows Ukrainians what is possible. And that's one of the reasons why he continues with the aggression to try to ensure that Ukraine remains as weak as possible. So for the United States, it's the dual goals that you highlighted. One is the standing up to Putin and showing support for Ukraine. But the other really important piece to that larger strategy is the anti-corruption efforts. And I think that was the second key message that was so prominent in Secretary Blinken's visit on Thursday. It was, yes, we are here with Ukraine to stand up to Russia, but also continuing to apply that pressure for Ukraine to take very seriously anti-corruption efforts and efforts to reduce the influence of oligarchs within the domestic political system, because ultimately that is what it will take to ensure Ukraine continues down a successful path.
Will Pomerantz, are you optimistic that Zelensky can, you know, make good on trying to fight corruption to the satisfaction of Washington?
That's a decades-long question, not only for Zelensky, but for Ukraine itself. In order to fight corruption, he has to fight oligarchs. He has to fight petty corruption. He has to clean up the bureaucracy. It is simply a huge task. And there have been efforts and there have been strides to combat corruption in Ukraine. But I think it has now been confirmed that this is a long-term strategy and that introducing the institutions that can combat corruption is going to be very difficult. And it's difficult not only because Zelensky has to mobilize his administration and the bureaucracy, but there also are elements within Ukrainian society and the Ukrainian legal system that, quite frankly, aren't helping. So there was a very large corruption scandal in the Constitutional Court, where the Constitutional Court essentially said that the bureau that is fighting corruption is unconstitutional, and it stopped all the prosecutions and investigations that were ongoing. So there is this sense of fatigue in Ukraine. They know what they need to do, but galvanizing the state and making that transition so that these institutions are in place to fight corruption has just proven to be very, very difficult.
Andrea Kendall-Taylor, how important will Ukraine's ability to tackle corruption be for it to move closer to the West? And are you of the opinion that eventually Ukraine should be part of the European Union?
Well, that's also a long-term question, because I think we're still quite a ways from what it would take to comply with what the European Union would be looking for. But as Anthony Blinken highlighted, the anti-corruption, those types of reforms are the single most important step to secure a strong, successful Ukraine. And without going through that painstaking process of implementing those reforms, that Ukraine will kind of fail to move towards that Euro-Atlantic integration that I think many in Ukraine so strongly support. I think that is one of the single most biggest impediments towards that Euro-Atlantic integration. In the long term, I mean, I think, again, just a really difficult question to know where Ukraine will be in its progress on making those reforms, and also where the European Union will be in its discussions about future enlargement.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Will Pomerantz, Deputy Director of the Cannon Institute at the Wilson Center, and Andrea Kendall-Taylor, Senior Fellow and Director of the Transatlantic Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. We are discussing how to combat Russia's continued aggression in eastern Ukraine. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Here's a shout out to a new Twitter follower, Dr. Radia Ishak from Sana'a, Yemen. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. So back to you, Will Pomerantz, back to trying to stabilize and turn down the temperature on the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. You both referenced the Minsk agreement. There's also something called the Normandy process, which I don't think the United States is a party to. If you could just explain where we are in both processes, to what extent are we making any progress?
The Minsk agreement was negotiated and signed at the height of the Ukraine crisis. And basically, Ukraine had to accept the conditions that were imposed by Russia. Essentially, Ukraine doesn't really want to engage and follow the Minsk protocols. They were signed when Ukraine was at its most disadvantage. And there are conditions in the Minsk protocols that are simply unacceptable to Ukraine, and rightfully so. So on the one hand, to negotiate the Minsk protocols, Ukraine would have to somehow make a compromise with the two breakaway republics in Donetsk and Luhansk and somehow make them autonomous regions within Ukraine. Ukraine is a unitary state, and it is just not possible for Ukraine to cede so much sovereignty and independence to these semi-autonomous republics and think that it can remain a unified country. So there's a problem for Ukraine in terms of negotiating via Minsk, but there is also a problem if it rejects the Minsk Accords, especially the European sanctions are predicated on following the Minsk protocols. For example, if Ukraine were to walk away from the Minsk protocols, then it runs the risk of losing the sanctions that were put on by the European Union, or somehow renegotiating those sanctions, and that would not be to the benefit of Ukraine. So this is the format that exists to keep the stalemate going, but it doesn't seem to be a format to resolve the crisis. And the final thing I'll say is I'm not sure that Vladimir Putin wants to resolve the crisis. I think he likes the leverage that the Donetsk People's Republic and Luhansk People's Republic can assert on Ukraine, and I'm not sure he's actually willing or even inclined to make some sort of final negotiation through the Minsk process.
And I'd like to now turn to Andrea Kendall-Taylor for your take about the Minsk protocols. Do you think that maybe the premise on which they were negotiated is in question with respect to these two Russian-speaking regions in the east of Ukraine, having them have a semi-autonomous status? It also brings up the very interesting question about this fascinating country, that it is really straddles two worlds. The western part of Ukraine is more western-oriented, and the east does seem to have greater identity with Russia, many Russian speakers in Luhansk and Donetsk. So how do we go forward?
Well, I think those are discussions that are being held and need to continue to be held through the Normandy process, which you referred to earlier. And the Normandy group, as you said, does not include the United States, but it's Russia, Germany, France, and Ukraine. I think, unfortunately, that Normandy process has in many ways stalled out, although we have upcoming elections in Germany where Chancellor Merkel will be stepping down. And so it'll be very interesting to see in terms of either breathing new life into these negotiations or if there'll be more German disinterest in this process, where we might see kind of the momentum or the focus of this shift more to France, where the French President Emmanuel Macron has been willing to pursue a more accommodating approach to the Kremlin. So I do think that there are a lot of questions about where the Normandy format goes moving forward. To Will's point, it's very unclear where Moscow wants to go with this process. It's unclear whether Putin actually wants to resolve the crisis, because as he said, what he ultimately wants is to prevent Ukraine from pursuing a more Euro-Atlantic trajectory. He wants to keep Ukraine in Russia's orbit. And I think the ultimate irony is through the actions that he has taken, he has actually alienated many Ukrainians. And that gets to the division that you're talking about. Many in Ukraine now look at Russia very differently than they did before the crisis. And it has very much reinforced Ukrainians' desire, particularly in the West, to integrate more closely into Western Europe. So it's a difficult situation. The Normandy process currently has very much stalled out, but we do have some elections coming up in Europe. So we'll be watching to see what that means for any progress on negotiations.
Back to you, Will Pomerantz. It's very interesting that you both agree that Vladimir Putin doesn't really seem to want to solve this crisis. This is sort of his MO. He likes to create chaos, and what better place than in Ukraine, straddling the East and the West? It's very sad. Ukraine is like a hostage. So the question is, how can we really solve this problem? Because we're seeing this troop buildup, which is excessive. And what about his interference in the Black Sea, Sea of Azov, I believe it's called? How menacing is that in your view?
Well, obviously, Vladimir Putin is trying to exacerbate the crisis for his own means. And I want to bring up other aspects of the crisis and show just how difficult it will be to solve. One, Andrea talked about the problems of the Normandy group and trying to implement the Minsk protocols. Over the last 2 years, Russia has given Russian passports to approximately 500,000 people in this region, in Donetsk and Luhansk. So they don't want to annex these two autonomous regions, but they are directly interfering with the composition of these autonomous regions. And this would be, of course, another big problem for Ukraine if it tries to absorb Luhansk and Donetsk, because now they're absorbing over 500,000 people who have Russian citizenship. And Russia has just proclaimed in its new constitution that it has a right to defend all Russians who are not in the Russian Federation. So it complicates the situation very much. Also, we haven't even mentioned the problems of Crimea. Clearly, Ukraine has not recognized the annexation of Crimea. But any attempt to stand up to that or to say that it's not legal will again implicate Russia. And Russia will obviously turn around and saying that Ukraine is interfering with the territorial integrity of Russia. And again, that's now against the Constitution after the 2020 amendments. The third things about water, I'll just mention the third water crisis, and that is Crimea doesn't have water, and it is dependent on Ukraine still providing water through its canal. And Ukraine has shut that canal down. So again, crisis that when will Russia decide, or will Russia decide, that it can't tolerate the fact that Ukraine has the ability to stop the water flowing to Crimea and will do something about it?
It seems like we're just bringing up more and more obstacles to any kind of resolution. Very difficult. Andrea, Kendall Taylor, anything to add or subtract to what Will said with regard to Russia's maneuvers in the region and how they are really impeding some sort of a compromise? The other question I have for you quickly is many European countries, they have interests, you know, with Russia in terms of gas. And I wonder, you know, how much of an effect that has or influence on their willingness to try to protect Ukraine.
On your second question, we have seen some convergence in Europe on the threat that Russia poses. So, you know, there are differences in views about the threat that Russia poses, depending whether you're in Eastern Europe versus in Southern Europe, for example. But I think in recent months, especially with the poisoning of Alexei Navalny and his imprisonment, and then again with the Russian military buildup in and around Ukraine, it has in many ways galvanized or led to a greater convergence in Europe about the Putin challenge. And so I am optimistic with the incoming Biden administration, who has made this an important priority, who is committed to investing in alliances, and who is committed to working in close coordination with European allies and partners on the Russia challenge, that we can begin to build a more unified and coherent coalition to push back against Russia, including in Ukraine. And I think with Secretary Blinken's trip to Ukraine, the key message and the key goal is for the United States, along with Europe, to support Ukraine's ability to stand up to Putin. That needs to happen both in a conventional sense, in the military sense, where there is, I think, growing support to increase security assistance to Ukraine. The United States already provides robust security assistance, but there is support, including in Congress, to increase that support and to do more so that Ukraine can raise the costs of additional Russian aggression in Ukraine. And then, as Will was saying, it's more than just the conventional threats. There's also disinformation operations, what they're doing in the Sea of Azov with maritime soft blockades that make it difficult for Ukraine to export its goods. I mean, Russia is kind of coming at Ukraine from all of these different dimensions. And so it will take multifaceted Western support, both in the military sense, but also on these anti-corruption reforms and efforts to strengthen democratic institutions in Ukraine. I think ultimately the goal of what the United States and Europe needs to do is, again, to strengthen Ukraine's ability to stand up to Putin. And I do think that we might see a bit more coordination between the United States and Europe, certainly relative to what we saw over the last 4 years, to work towards that goal.
Well, on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this particular edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my terrific guests, Will Pomerantz. He's Deputy Director of the Cannon Institute at the Wilson Center, and Andrea Kendall Taylor, Senior Fellow and Director of the Transatlantic Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. I look forward to continuing our conversation in the near future. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.